Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today is an episode in a replay series. We revisit my discussion with Professor Ben Hine from the 24th of November 2024. It originally aired as episode 59. Professor Hine is expansive in this episode on family court and family breakup issues, and he compares how things are in the UK with other countries. It's a really good discussion. Thanks to Professor Hine for being on the show. And here we go. Welcome to the podcast. Today, our guest is Professor Ben Hine. Ben is a psychologist and professor of applied psychology and head of the School of Human and Social Sciences at the University of West London. He's a chartered psychologist with the British Psychological Society, and he has a BSc in psychology and a PhD from Royal Holloway University of London. In addition to his research, Professor Hine is also an accomplished teacher and mentor. He has won several awards for his teaching, including the Vice Chancellor's Teaching Excellence Award at the University of Winchester. His research is wide-ranging, including a focus on gender within the criminal justice system, and includes two large-scale projects assessing police officers' belief and judgments and rape case reviews in collaboration with the Mayor's Office for Policing and Crime. He has worked in collaboration with charities, Safe Lives and the Mankind Initiative to conduct large-scale case reviews to illuminate the needs of domestic violence victims. He now leads the Evidence-Based Domestic Abuse Research Network, bringing together researchers from several UK institutions to deliver this work. He's also researched the impact of family breakdown and experience with institutions such as the family court. He's a founder of the Men and Boys Coalition, a network of organisations, academics, journalists, professionals and leaders committed to highlighting and acting on the gender-specific issues that affect men and boys, such as the high male suicide rate, the boys' educational crisis, and fatherhood. He also acts as a trustee to the Mankind Initiative, and within the School of Human and Social Sciences, he acts as the lead for research and enterprise. In this wide-ranging discussion, Ben discusses shared parenting, family court, change initiatives, and much more. Welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for agreeing to join us today. Can you tell us a little bit about your work? I know it covers psychology, family court, gender in the criminal justice system. Can you tell us a bit more about that and anything else you cover in your research?
Yeah, absolutely. So my work kind of intersects a lot of different areas of psychology. So my teaching background is actually developmental psychology. And then I also teach a lot around kind of gender psychology, and then apply that in forensic settings, which is anything to do with our legal system. So I kind of operate in this kind of space, this Venn diagram between those different areas, mainly in the area of domestic and sexual violence. And so I've spent a lot of time over my career looking at hidden groups of domestic violence. So, for example, male victims and LGBTQIA plus individuals in those relationships, looking at their experiences and how their gender and sexuality identities shape their victimization and survivorship. And out of that work grew a focus on a particular form of abuse where parents target the relationship between the child and the other parent, which is known by a few different names. Parental alienation is probably the one people would recognize, but other people have called them parent-child bond-breaking behaviors. So I've kind of gravitated towards that space, and in doing so, actually become much more interested in how we manage any level of conflict post-separation, where that might jeopardize shared parenting practices. And whenever you have a focus on a kind of negative side of a phenomenon, it also piques your interest in the positive side. So I've also done a lot of looking into best practices in terms of shared parenting and how we can promote those practices in order to hopefully guard against levels of conflict in post-separated couples. So just kind of lots of different things, but all related to the same phenomenon of essentially wanting to keep parents happy when they are parenting together for the sake of children.
Yes. You mentioned best practices. Is that from, I mean, I assume, I may be wrong, but I assume you're looking at the UK predominantly. Mm. And so when you talk about best practices, would that be looking at how other countries do things?
Yeah, so when we look at, when I say best practice, that kind of falls into two areas. That's best practice based on what we know from the literature, the academic literature. So what generally does the academic literature say about who should be having ongoing relationships with children and in what context, as well as specific examples of how to promote that on a practice and policy level. Because what we see from the literature, and there's been a couple of quite large-scale reviews over the last, say, 5-6 years, is what we generally see and the general message that comes out of that literature is that after couples separate, it is generally in the child's best interests, and this is codified in, for example, you know, the UN Rights of the Child, etc., that children have an ongoing relationship with both parents. And obviously there are caveats to that. For example, that has to be in a situation where there isn't a significant risk of harm to the child, because that obviously counters any benefit that they would get. But generally, if you have a child who has formed attachments to caregivers whilst those caregivers were in a relationship, it is generally best for the child in terms of a whole variety and range of outcomes to have ongoing contact with those parents. There is a lot of other caveats and debates and areas of further inquiry that we need to make about what factors influence that positive relationship and the positive benefit. So for example, those could be individual characteristics, those could be situational, they could be, for example, what type of living arrangement that looks like, because some children respond differently. So some children might not mind going to and from houses and sharing resources, some children might mind that. So there are a lot of additional caveats to that, and that really feeds into this idea that no post-separated family is the same, and every family needs to find the best solution for them. But it is underpinned by a general principle supported by the literature that children should have an ongoing relationship with caregivers once they separate. In terms of best practice, there are a few countries that do things better, for example, than us, because at the moment we do not have a very good post-separation infrastructure in place. And that can lead to negative outcomes where couples end up in these situations of high conflict, potentially because they don't have someone there mediating that process or helping them with that process. So there's not enough resources available. Yeah. And we do see that in other countries. So, for example, a lot of the Scandinavian countries, and there are different, you know, there are different models that are put in place. Some countries have, for example, mandatory mediation, which I don't actually think is a good thing. Because not all couples should go to mediation, but there are structures in place. For example, in Finland, where mediation is voluntary, but it's much, much better funded, and it's much more of a societal expectation that you should go to mediation and try and sort out your problems, for example, before you go to family court. So there's a lot that needs to be done on lots of different levels in order to, for example, promote a really kind of robust best practice model. And that includes kind of societal stereotypes around separation and how we should do that, all the way down to specific intervention and what should be done. But there's definitely, we definitely need a lot more dialogue, for example, in this country about how we could be doing things better. And we are starting to have that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say in Finland, there's a cultural element where they expect, you know, people, and that's obviously outside the justice system, which is where UK a lot of family court resides. Yeah. And it becomes adversarial, unfortunately, and almost incentivized into conflict. And it's conflict is funded by the Ministry of Justice in some terms, in some ways. There can be sometimes incentives to have high conflict cases, because I don't think we have the cultural
expectation of mediation that you sort of said exists in Finland.
I think the way I would characterize it is, I think we need, if instead of getting into specific issues, I would talk about it in terms of the general framing of the issue. And the way I would characterize it is that in the UK, I think we have a broadly unhealthy relationship with separation. And in places like Finland, they broadly, as a culture and a society, have a healthy relationship with separation. And what I mean by that is that they have, and this is underpinned by a lot of other concepts that they do, I think, in my opinion, much better in terms of gender equality and shared parental leave and all of this kind of thing, is that they generally have a more sophisticated and positive understanding of separation, in the sense that they acknowledge that it sometimes happens. They have a cultural awareness of that and that it can be done well. And they have then infrastructure, corresponding infrastructure that supports that notion, because they have this statutory kind of state-funded robust mediation of physical spaces for people to go and do that. So I think generally it's just a healthier relationship with that concept. I think in this country, certainly this is my opinion, I think we have an unhealthy relationship with separation, where it is fundamentally and automatically seen as an unavoidably negative experience. And that is potentially underpinned by longstanding legislation. And I'm aware this has changed recently, where we had fault-based divorce proceedings, where someone had to be at fault. Obviously, we now have no fault divorce legislation, but that's only very recent. And it takes a long time for that to filter into the public consciousness. And I think things like that, so the legislation, the fact that there is no, you know, real robust, systematic, statutorily funded support for parents separating, it kind of underpins this idea that it is a taboo, it's inherently negative, it's impossible, someone's at fault, it's adversarial, you're going to have to go to court to figure it out. And then when we then make further comparisons to places like Finland, we also do not have all of that legislation that promotes the healthier relationship within intact relationships, like the robust shared parental leave, you know, et cetera, things like that. So I think at most levels, our foundations for this concept and our attitude about it and our relationship with it as a society is quite negative. And I think that's probably, albeit the hardest thing to change, is probably the most important thing to change. Because without any of that, you're not going to get the corresponding tangible, practical changes that you need in legislation, in policy, and in practice to actually change the issue. The other important thing to say is, I think that it's also not seen principally as a legal issue in Finland. It's seen principally as a relational issue, or a psychological issue, or a mental health issue. So I think that helps as well, because people understand that when they separate, they are experiencing a stressor, a trauma. So it's much more psychologically informed. And therefore, the response to that is, we should have a trauma-informed approach, which is that you probably need to go and speak to someone about it, have a mediator there, send to the voice of the children, etc. I think we predominantly see separation and the associated issues that arise from it as a legal issue in this country, which means that people will gravitate towards the legal solutions. And as you've already noted, those legal solutions do not actually help in many cases. And of course, there are cases that will always end up in court because they have to be there because of the level of risk or harm or complication.
Yeah.
But I would be willing to bet there is a vast majority that if they had had the opportunity to sit down with a mediator in a societal, with a societal backdrop that that was an okay thing to do, and that they should be doing that, and it was the benefit of the children, etc., we had all that in place, we would probably see similar percentages like we do in Finland, which I think is sub 10% of couples that end up going to court, probably even lower than that, I think. So I think there's a lot, you know, there is a lot we can learn from other countries. And I always hold up Finland. You know, Finland's not perfect, no country is. But in my opinion, it's models like that that are at least doing a heck of a lot better job than we are currently doing, I think, to support separating couples. And I know there are dialogues going on about this, and I don't want to inadvertently demonize anybody or any sector or anything like that. You know, I, in my work, I speak with a lot of different individuals, including family lawyers, many of whom are very decent, upstanding individuals who are seeking the best outcomes for children. I think it's obviously impossible, though, to operate in a system that is constructed in the way that ours is without getting sucked into, as either the practitioner or the client, an adversarial positioning. And that's, you know, that's this, ours is not even the worst example. It's obviously a lot worse in the US. So yeah, it's, there's a lot to be done.
Well, it's interesting that you say that the US is even worse. It's hard to imagine, but I know in the US that some states have got a presumption of 50-50 in.
Yeah.
And that seems to be increasing over time. But are you sort of saying that they apply it badly, or the state?
Well, it's probably unfair of me to say the US, because that essentially you've got a country of 50 countries. So
yeah,
there is a huge variation. And actually, I must correct myself and point out that actually the states that have implemented a 50-50 presumption of shared care legislation have seen a massive drop in the amount of litigation that they see in their states.
Really?
States like Kentucky, for example, has seen a massive drop, huge drop, you know, several dozens of percentage points down with the amount of couples that are going to court. Because I think it's amazing how powerful, this is one of the things that I personally argue for and I think would be a positive step. There are others who don't think that. I'm always happy to debate why and why not, but I do think it would be a positive introduction in this country to have a presumption of 50-50 shared care. Because at the moment in this country, we have a presumption of parental responsibility. So we make it clear to individuals that if they're a parent before their separation, they're still a parent after their separation, and that they have responsibility for a child. Now, the problem with that is that it doesn't give any framework for what that actually looks like.
Yeah.
And the brilliant thing about a presumption of 50-50 is that it does give some kind of framework to say that the baseline that you're starting from is that there should be a kind of roughly equal or equitable contribution to this child's life in terms of not just responsibility and decision making, but contact and care. And I think the thing that people misunderstand about a presumption statutory guidance is that it would mandate and dictate that all families have to do 50-50. And I think that's a very damaging misinterpretation, because that's not what it's saying at all.
Yeah,
it's saying that there is a presumption that unless otherwise necessary, the only reason that you would then go to court is if you were arguing against that principle. Whereas at the moment, because there's no principle in place, if you are unhappy with any kind of split between your time, you have to go to court to rectify it.
Yes.
And that's the issue. And we couples would be more than welcome to sit down if this presumption was in place and say, actually, it works for us to have a 60-40, or it works for us to have a 70-30, or, you know, I have them for 2 weeks and then you have them for 2 weeks. It's not saying everybody has to do 50-50. It's saying that that's the presumption that you would then go to a court with, and you would have to argue against as to why that isn't beneficial to the child. And I think that's really powerful, because it sets the tone for any post-separation conversations. And we've seen in those states that it has a huge impact on the amount of cases going to court, which will have a positive impact on children and adults' mental health and well-being. But the debate is nuanced, and there are lots of, there are lots of valid points as to how that could potentially influence those kind of conversations that are being had, whether it would enable people to, entrap people in relationships of saying, well, otherwise we'll have to go to court. But I would argue that's essentially the state of play that we have at the moment. I think people are getting caught in custody situations that are deeply we don't use custody anymore, sorry, child contact arrangements that are deeply unfair.
Yeah.
For the same reason that they don't want to go to court. So I think at least if we had a presumption, it would give an idea to couples as to where they should be beginning. And I think that's what we're missing. Because, you know, you can easily have responsibility for a child without ever seeing them.
Yes.
So in my opinion, a presumption of responsibility is not enough to protect that role that parents should be having within their child's life. And then it should be up to the, you know, if necessary, it then should be up to the court to argue against that or to facilitate arguments against that. So, yeah, when I said that the US is worse, I think the main comment that I'm making about the US, apologies for that, is there are variations, of course. And I think even in states where there is that presumption in existence, I think my main comment about the US is once you get to court, their court system is even more incentivized and monetized. Right. And adversarial. Yeah. I do actually think there are some states that are giving a good example of the direction we should be following to try and keep people out of that system.
Yeah.
But, and similarly, I would just also like to point out that's also not me demonizing and saying every US lawyer is a predatory kind of, you know, horrible individual, because I speak with many US lawyers and US lawyers around and solicitors and barristers around the world that are doing this because they care about children. But I think it's impossible for anybody who is in that system not to get sucked into it. And that's including children. And I speak as a child who went through that system. It's hard not to get sucked into it as a child as well.
Yeah. One, I'll make a silly analogy. Perhaps it's rubbish, but I'll do it anyway. And that strikes me, the presumption of 50-50 very simplistically it reminds me of organ donor cards in the UK, where you used to have to carry a card, and that brought about low results of donorship. You know, somebody died, you had a small window of time, you had to rush around and find relatives, and then that switched a few years ago, I forget how many now, but so that you had to opt out of it, and so that's brought about better levels of donation. I think it just flipping something can be powerful, and so the flip to a presumption of 50-50, where you then have to go to court if you don't want that, I think is a very powerful thing, and it's quite a simple remedy.
Sorry, just quickly. Yeah. I think for me, it's about expectation and baseline standard setting. And I think that's what we're missing societally.
Yeah.
Is because that baseline isn't there. And you're not going to achieve that, sadly, through a public awareness campaign. It has to come from, I mean, it could be paired with a public awareness campaign. And I would love to see a public awareness campaign that talks about separation and how we should be doing it. And obviously, I'd love to see it paired with relationships and sex education in schools around this topic, etc. There's lots of other parts of this puzzle.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, change in society does not come unless it is legislatively underpinned.
Right.
And you see this, for example, with drink driving. There is no public campaign that you could have run on its own that would have changed people drink driving. It has to be underpinned by some kind of consequence or some kind of framework. So I think the most powerful tool in reframing our understanding of the issue and getting it embedded into the public consciousness that unless there is a reason otherwise, there should be a presumption that parents have a robust kind of input into children's lives after separation. Whether that's exactly 50-50 or not is then up for parents to decide. But having a 50-50 presumption underpins the principle that is supported in the academic literature that a continuing relationship with both parents is a positive thing unless there is serious risk of harm to the child. And, you know, some people would argue, yes, but that means that a victim would have to go to court in order to argue that their abuser shouldn't have 50% of the time. But that's the case anyway. If you have a situation where you're in a relationship with a partner that's abusive, whether they are, whether there is a 50% presumption there, or whether they've ended up with 20%, or whether you want them out of the child's life for good because they are a risk to them, you would have to go to court anyway. So I don't, and I may be misunderstanding it, and I'm always happy to have conversations with people if they feel I'm misrepresenting this view. I don't think it would have much impact on the need to go to court or on the decision of the court. I think because the fundamentally is that the court observes the facts. So whether you go and it's, and there's a presumption in the background or not, you would go to the court and the court would evaluate and do a fact-finding hearing, and they would come to this, I think, a similar conclusion, whether that presumption is there or not. What the presumption acts to and what it speaks to is the huge chunk of people who probably do not reach the risk threshold to actually need to go to court, but end up there anyway because they can't decide between 20 or 30%.
Yes.
You know, and so what it does is it underpins it, it kind of challenges those couples to be better and to get to a higher threshold before they consider going to court, because a judge is going to turn around and say, actually, there's nothing to hear here.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it kind of, that for me is the power of introducing the presumption. Sorry to jump in again, but I think that's the power it holds, is to set that baseline presumption and to empower judges to go, actually, your case doesn't belong here. And also to empower solicitors to say, we shouldn't really be taking this to court, and to empower mediators to say, let's work with this presumption. You know, it should hopefully, and it's been shown to be the case in states where they have it. So, yeah.
Yes. I mean, at the moment in the UK, I think there's a big problem with false allegations, and what you've just described would filter that out. Because I think in UK, you can make a false allegation. You can then use that to drive contact down to zero. And then somebody's got to, because that presumption of 50-50 is not in place, you're then having somebody who could be a year without contact trying to fight their way to having some contact because it's good for the child. Mm. And then you get courts saying, you know, they can take a year or more to get to a fact find. And then you get to this stage where, okay, we've got to introduce contact slowly because it's coming from zero. And then you could hit another round of false allegations that then drive that back again, breaking of court orders that drive it back again. And so, because of that lack of presumption and the incentivizing of false allegations, it just becomes very, very unhealthy in the UK. Whereas what you've just described sounds much, much better. But, you know, you it's 50-50, but if you've got real evidence of abuse or danger, then go to court. And then, because there would be less cases in the system, they could actually look at these allegations more quickly, which is better for everyone, including the children.
Well, that's... I'll come back to false allegations in a second, but the last thing that you touched upon was essentially the most important thing that we're trying to do with any action that we take. And that's reinforced by Sir Andrew McFarlane and his comments that he's made over the past couple of years, which is fundamentally what we are looking to do is reduce demand.
Yeah.
Because through demand reduction, we will be able to speed up the cases that genuinely need to be in the courts and not end up in this situation like you've described, where there may be a situation where a parent does not have contact, wrongfully does not have contact with a child for months and months and months. Coming back to false allegations, I want to just caveat this with a couple of points. False allegations are incredibly difficult and complicated to explore and investigate for obvious reasons. And when we talk about false allegations, there is the automatic assumption that kind of feeds into a general and widespread disbelief of claims. Usually when we talk about these things, or advocates talk about these things, they're saying in relation to women, of women's and mothers' claims of domestic violence. I think what I would say is that we need to get to a sensible position on the issue, which is that, as with any type of behavior and any type of crime, false allegations inevitably do exist. And I have spoken with solicitors, I've spoken with individuals, both mothers and fathers, who have been falsely accused And the evidence is there to demonstrate that it was a false allegation, strong evidence to suggest it's a false allegation. So we cannot be in a position of either extreme where we like where we can pretend that false allegations don't exist, because of course they do, or where it goes to the other extreme where we're saying most of the accusations within the system are false, because that's highly unlikely as well.
Yeah.
However, false allegations are an issue, and they do lead to, at the moment, extreme situations of no contact, which are, in some cases, if indeed the accusation is found to be false, are therefore unwarranted and hugely damaging to the parent and the child. And so I agree that a presumption of 50-50 combined with several other things, so much better support post-separation, general better attitude towards separation in society, combined with making sure that that presumption of 50-50 is underpinned with the financial presumptions that that comes with, because I think that is a big issue within this system at the moment, is how money comes into it and how child support comes into it, and how that provides part of a potential incentivization for people to go to court and to figure those arrangements out. Combined with, you see how broad this problem is, combined with going back into intact relationships and looking at our policy supporting parents before they've separated, because I feel that a lot of the underpinning issues with this comes from, you know, things like unequal shared parental leave from in intact relationships, which lay the foundations for inequality post-separation. So I think there's so many pieces of this puzzle that lead up to a situation where, for one reason or another, you potentially have a parent making a false allegation of abuse towards another parent in order to reduce their contact time, to cause pain to that other parent, and to potentially extract a financial incentive, etc. And I think the principal thing I would just root all of these things back to is whether you are going to court with a genuine accusation of abuse and you, and trying to get that parent out of that child's life, or if you're going to court and you are falsely accusing a parent or you're being falsely accused, all of the considerations that we have to make as a society and as a court is around the impact that that is having on the child. And I think that's why we need to have a balanced conversation about this, because it is absolutely right and necessary that we have a family court system in place that deals with genuine accusations of domestic violence that put children at risk and that make and take actions accordingly, for example, in child contact orders. It is also vitally important that we have a pre-court system and then subsequently court system that is informed and educated enough to also be able to deal with and understand the concept that sometimes parents, for whatever reason, will falsely accuse another parent, and that that needs to be fully explored and investigated in order to come to the right conclusion and potentially then keep that parent in that child's life because they're not abusive.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, both of those situations is around making sure that the child has the best possible outcome and the best possible well-being. And what people, I think, don't understand about the latter argument is how damaging removing a healthy, loving parent from a child is. And it's and the level and damage that that does and the equivalency that has of having an abusive parent stay in a child's life. So I think it's really important that we tackle and we have a system that is equipped to tackle both of those issues. And a big part of that for me is almost kind of filtering out couples that we could deal with pre-court to a much greater extent, to inform them with that understanding, and then to move on to those cases where, yes, you do need to do a fact find and discover what's going on. But you're right to say that at the moment, it's farcical. And you do have situations where I've spoken to, again, I want to be clear, both mothers and fathers that have been accused of domestic violence wrongly. They had an ex parte hearing held against them that resulted in a non-molestation, no contact order that went on for months before they could even get a hearing.
Yes.
They would then get a preliminary hearing where they might have overseen contact in place. which is rare, you know, and periodic.
Yeah.
Several months go by and then there's a fact find. By the time that it comes out that there was no domestic abuse, there's no evidence of domestic violence within the core,
yep.
you've had potentially years of disrupted contact between a healthy, loving, good enough parent and a child, which has long-lasting damage. And yep. so it all feeds into all of the arguments that we make in this area. And I'm always open with discussing this with people because there are differences of opinion of how we do this. All of us, I think, are pulling towards the same outcome, which is trying to protect children.
Okay, there's a couple of points come out of that. One is you mentioned subsequent systems after court. Would that be to do with mental health of supporting parents who've been through traumatic court proceedings or just recording of outcomes, because I don't think family court records outcomes of their judgments, and
right.
they don't seem to know whether they what their judgments whether the judgments do good or the reverse. So what did you mean by subsequent systems?
Yeah, I think that's generally, you know, I'm very front loaded because I think that's where the most impact is going to be.
Yeah,
in terms of I think, you know, I'm actually looking backwards into the intact relationship. But then if you fast forward and say, okay, well, inevitably there are individuals that go through court. I think one of the things that's come out of my research more than anything is that there needs to be a tangible outcome if a court order is violated. So that for me is one of the most direct things that we can do on the other end is if you get to a situation where, yes, a couple has been through court, if they've needed it, and it's turned out that there's been a finding, either way, you know, it could be that a finding that the DV was false and there's now a 50-50 arrangement in place, or it could be a finding that the DV was true and then there's a protection order in place. What we see is that there is a vast disparity in how the court responds to breaking court orders, depending on what those orders are and who's doing the breaking.
Yes.
And if we have a system that is so poor in terms of its post kind of judgment delivery and monitoring, you are going to have people who test that system. And once they find out that they can break a contact order with impunity, they will, of course, keep doing so.
Yes.
And we see that happening a lot. And we see principally a narrative around the work I've done is talking with fathers whose mothers break contact orders. But I've certainly spoken with mothers whose fathers does that. And the issue with both of those cases is that fundamentally there's just not capacity. So if you have a situation, and I'm not saying the court should be this responsive, but you know, if you have a situation where you were meant to have a handover, it was an important handover for whatever reason, maybe there was a family event, you were meant to have a handover at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, that handover has not occurred and that is a breach of a contact order, it might be months.
Yes.
Before you are in front of a judge talking about that breach, by which point, I mean, it's a distant memory.
Yes.
And there may have been tens of other breaches in the meantime that you are trying to then periodically add and to the file that you've put into the court. And it's just that the system is, I'm not saying that, you know, you should get a hearing in the afternoon of that Saturday and say, oh, this morning something happened. But the timelines at the moment are farcical.
Yes.
And so even if there is some consequence for breaking, you know that you're going to have at least 3 or 4 months before you're even having to argue a case in front of the judge.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing really motivating either parent in any situation, whether it's DV related or not, whatever the contact order is. I would argue that sadly, there isn't really much motivating the parent at all to not just do what they want to do anyway. It depends on the type of parent you are. Some parents are more, I'm trying to think of the word, responsive to contact orders and responsive to the rule of law. So, you know, for some parents, it will shake them and say, right now I have a contact order in place. I have to abide by this.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of parents who, for whatever reason, due to their own situational trauma or factors or triggers or whatever, will have no problem overriding a court order.
Yes.
And that happens very frequently. And what that does is it feeds back into a system that's groaning under the weight of hearings. So at the moment, yeah, there is equal issue, I think, on the back end of court in terms of how we manage that, how we go forward, how we not only judicially administer outcomes, but then pastorally kind of take care of families after their arrangement is in place, and the check, the type of check-ins that we do and their regularity. So I think, yeah, there's nothing about the separation process from start to end that really screams great to me. So yeah, lots to be done, I think.
Yes, yes. And obviously things can escalate once a parent learns they can break an order, they break it again. As you say, you can wait months and months and months, and then a false allegation's made, and it can become just a playbook. And you know, 3-4 years go by, and it just a case just balloons. Whereas if it had been dealt with massively at the beginning, and also if the societal, the cultural aspects that you mentioned is in Finland, if things like that were in place, well, then perhaps people would frown at a parent acting in those kind of ways.
Oh, they would.
Wouldn't happen.
They would.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would. And I think, you know, I think sadly in this country, I think we have too many of those conversations that happen within the home or with friends or with other family where they say, why should you do that? Why should you do that? And kind of almost geeing the parent up into this adversarial position. I think we have too much of that. So I think societally we have a role.
Yeah.
And the actors around us to say, look, I know you don't like him or her, but it's in the child's best interest, blah, blah, blah. And look, I'm not saying these conversations are easy, and they're also not relevant in any situation. I'm not saying that families should stand around and force a parent to give a child over to a parent that's risky or abusive or causing harm. Yeah. I'm saying I think there's too much of those conversations when they aren't necessary.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing just to mention is all these hearings cost money.
Yes.
And they cost physical and mental energy. And so... And also, you have, because of that, you have more and more individuals who are operating as litigants in person.
Yeah.
And whilst they are doing their best, they are not in a position often to effectively argue their case in front of judges. Judges get frustrated. They are quicker to throw cases out when they're litigants in person because they don't have the necessary information, which isn't the client's fault, but it's the system. So, it you know, it's very easy to then break an order and then entrap someone in a series of broken orders and you make it so that it's financially unsustainable for them to fight against it, you know, all of these kind of things. And like you said, it becomes a playbook.
Yeah.
The other thing I will touch upon is when you have those breaks in contact and depending on the dynamic that's at play, that is when alienating behaviors can be most powerful.
Yes.
Because you are all your, you know, any action that you can take to extend the time away from the target parent makes alienating behaviors more powerful, because the most basic and powerful remedy to alienating behaviors is contact with the targeted parent.
Yeah.
Because you might have an alienating parent who spends their whole week sniping and denigrating and creating a culture of fear around the parent.
Yeah.
And if that targeted parent then gets contact for even a few hours,
that can
undo a lot of that. Because all they have to do is present as a safe, loving parent, and the child goes, hold on a minute, you're not what I was told. And it actually is very powerful. Now, that's probably one of the principal reasons why people break contact orders, is because they don't want that remedy to their behavior.
Yes.
And so they think, if I can just keep this child away, I can keep fostering this idea, not least because they'll probably feed they almost certainly will feed that child a reason to do with the targeted parent, not them. They won't say, oh yeah, I stopped you having contact. They'll probably lie and say, you know, your parent didn't want to see, you know, and form the alienating behavior. So that's another reason why that post court, if we can even call it that, because most people who've been to court would say you never really leave again, but that kind of post court care and procedure and strategy is also much lacking.
Yeah. Two other things that come out of that. One, the first one is you mentioned Finland and cultural aspect, and then you mentioned that you need legislation is more important than, for example, public information. Although you said that's really important too, and that it would be a great thing to see in Britain some public information films, but I'm wondering, do you think, is it a chicken and egg thing? Which comes first? Do you need the legislation and then the cultural change? Or will the legislation ever happen unless the culture shifts to some degree?
I don't think it's chicken and egg. I think it's farmer chicken egg.
Right.
So I think if I was to extend your farmyard analogy, so in my analogy, the farmer is advocacy. It's people and academia working together to inform about the issue.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to have a widespread cultural change that comes about through just through nothing.
Yeah.
So you're not going to get the egg in that situation, or the chicken, whichever one you're assigning. What you need is a dedicated kind of push and channel. So in this case, a farmer who is taking the decision to buy a chicken in the hope to get an egg.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. So what you need is advocacy and academia that come together and say, look, this is what we know about the issue, and this is what we think should happen. And it's what that will then drive the legislative change, that will drive the cultural change, that then becomes a kind of self-sustaining loop where the culture responds hopefully well and people see a benefit, which reinforces the need for the legislation and so on and so forth. But often you don't have those sparks without an interested individual group of individuals that take the position on this. And this is why we're desperately working to get the all-party parliamentary group for separation back up and running after the election, because all APPGs get dissolved when an election is called and they have to be reinstated, because it's exactly that type of vehicle which brings together the leading voices on the issue and members of parliament, policymakers, people of influence, to come together and produce key recommendations, which we actually did before the election was called. We got a report out, because I'm on that APPG, which said, the principal two biggest things at the moment is that we need a minister who will act on this issue across departments, as well as a conversation about infrastructure. Can we use existing infrastructure like family hubs to get people where they need to go? So we have started to do that, but that I think is the kind of timeline you're looking at. And that's been with any kind of issue, is that you need interested individuals, and those can come from within the legislature, by the way. It can be interested individuals, MPs, lords, ladies, who take, you know, this issue to heart for whatever reason. They then drive forward the legislative change, which, for example, is things like court reform, which is already underway. So, for example, the Pathfinder courts, which are trying to deal with DV accusations much quicker and much more efficiently by doing information gathering ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But also things like legislative change in terms of 50-50 presumptions, which can be pushed through as a empirically informed issue, which would then have consequent cultural change. But that for me is the timeline. And like you said at the start, it's not the legislative change is the only thing. I think it's, for me, it's the most important puzzle piece in a much bigger puzzle, which includes sex and relationships education on separation, public awareness campaigns, role models, celebrity endorsement, you know, all of these kind of things that add up to societal change. And it can be things like soap opera storylines.
Yeah.
I think we need to explore that more. Like, what do separated parents look like on TV, and getting that into homes? Because that has been one of the most powerful ways that we've increased awareness of male victims.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's been a couple of good, really well-written soap storylines about male victims of SV and male victims of DV that have really caught the public imagination and increased awareness of the issue. And that's what we mean. That's what I mean by this farmer, is because it needs some kind of dedicated catalyst that then feeds into the policymakers and the people in power.
Right. That seems very clear and interesting. And yeah, it gives a good perspective that I can understand now. So thanks very much for that. When you talk about the all party group and legislative change, I mean, I've heard other people talk about business and industry, that when you look to reinvent or disrupt them, you get what's called, or what they call, an allergic reaction from vested interests. Now, this is, I've heard it in terms of, you know, businesses but and industries. But within law and, you know, I don't think you have to look too far to find vested interests in the family court. There's obviously people making a lot of money out of the state. Wow. And there are also people at all ends of spectrums of thought to do with families. I would think that vested interests are a barrier to any sort of change, whether it's in government or society or business. Do you anticipate that that's going to be a real problem here or not?
I think it's inevitable. It would be the same as any, I think it's the same as any issue, any large moral issue that has a monetized side to it. And again, I go back to my example of drink driving. I mean, I can only imagine the lobbying that probably took place by companies, whatever those may be, brewers or whatever, or pubs, all this kind of thing, lobbying to say, this will impact our business economically too much for you to put this through. I think one of the tools we then have to use against that is to highlight the scale and the morality of the issue. And I think that's the only way to overcome that. So yes, I do anticipate challenges. We actually already experienced them from those sectors that you've mentioned. And we find, you know, when we propose things that are around demand reduction, then yes, you do get a lack of support, shall we say, from, for example, you know, the sector, the family lawyer sector. But I think what the most powerful remedy to that is demonstrating the scale of the issue, which is easily done statistically. It's easily done to show the scale of the issue. It's one of the principal, this is why I think it's astonishing we don't, for example, have a dedicated minister for this issue, because it's so wide ranging and affects so many people and children every year in the country. But that's easily demonstrable. And then I think we need much more information, and we need to put that information in the hands of the people that need it, on the damage that the processes do to individuals involved. And that's why I've currently got a large scale project under review. We're still waiting to find out the outcome, and I hope it's successful. And if it's not, I will do some of it anyway, which is trying to do the first kind of major longitudinal study of separated families' mental health when they are either in or out of court, which we're looking to do over the course of a year. And we're looking to interview children and parents to look at what the impact is on them, to provide that evidence base to say enough is enough, even if people are going to kick up a fuss and it's going to affect business. The cost benefit, you know, is too great to ignore anymore. Yeah, and that's my job as an academic. That's really where my job begins and ends, really, is to get that evidence and to get it to the people that need it, and to say, you know, because I think, for example, we have a huge misunderstanding about, and from the politicians I've spoken to and other individuals I've spoken to, I don't think people actually do know fundamentally it's better for children if they have a continued relationship with both parents. I don't think that is a standard state of knowledge, which is very sad.
Yeah.
I don't think, and why would they? But I don't think people have a good enough, well, the people that should have this understanding, I don't think have a good enough understanding about the way attachment works. And the way that if you have created a situation where a child is securely attached to a caregiver, removing them is a negative thing.
Yes.
You know, I think it's amazing people don't understand that. And I think people don't understand, for example, that theory applies to both mothers and fathers. I just don't think that state of knowledge is there. So I think there's a lot of work to be done, and that's what we do. That's our job as academics, because I'm not an advocate, I'm an academic, is to put my knowledge and the knowledge of others into the hands of advocates and politicians to say, this should equip you to make the necessary decision that you need to make.
Yeah.
And that should... And my job is to try and make that as compelling as possible. And the advocate's job is to then make that argument compelling as possible so that it outweighs an allergic reaction from a sector that should be, you know, foreseen. I mean, it's not going to take a Mensa application to understand that family lawyers don't want less cases, you know. But by the same token, and again, I really do want to avoid mischaracterizing all family lawyers as kind of greedy money hoarders who just want to, you know, milk cases, because a lot of them do it for very right reasons. But yeah. There is money involved, and we need to consider that. But, you know, no child's mental well-being is worth any amount of money. So if that makes sense, that's not, I don't know if I phrased that right, but, you know, it's priceless to protect a child's mental health is what I was trying to say.
Yeah, I did an episode with Raymond Heckmatt, who's a lawyer in, ex-family lawyer in Beverly Hills. And he said in California they have collaborative law, which they're trialing or trying. Some lawyers.
Yes, yeah, I have heard some about this, yeah.
Yeah, and he made the point that, you know, a lot of lawyers are not interested because, you know, there's less money in it, but he, you know, but some are. And so I think that showed that they're not all bad, but.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, because a lot of the time people are attracted to industries. Because look, fundamentally, is family law easy? No, it's really hard. And so you kind of have to get to a point. Maybe this is very naive. Some listeners will think I'm naive here, but I think you have to get to a point and go, why would someone sign up? I get it, it's heavily monetized, but it's still very stressful. And I think I do genuinely believe that a lot of people gravitate towards the area because they want to help and they have that drive and maybe they've had a personal experience. But fundamentally, yeah, I get that why lawyers wouldn't want to engage in collaborative law, because in collaborative law, you know, you've got a case where collaboratively, if you work on it, it's probably going to be two hearings. Whereas if you really kick them up into a fuss and get them to fight, it's going to be 10. You know, that's five times the amount more money. And, you know, we're that's part of living in a capitalist society, is that we're often, all of us are driven. That's a huge factor for a lot of us. And yeah, we want to earn money and they'll be looking to look after their own family. So they'll frame it that way. So I think any consultation, any change that you would make in this area, of course, will have an inevitable backlash against it from those with vested interests. It is up to those fighting for that cause to make a compelling enough argument to override that, is my kind of conclusion on that.
Yeah. And you mentioned the all-party group and the fact that it's obviously they all get dissolved at election time. Now, that's obviously quite disruptive. I mean, I've heard government being criticised before because they take, you know, not just in the UK but worldwide, where you have, you know, 4 or 5 year government, and that they get criticised even in terms of infrastructure development. They're too short sighted because they're just looking at the next election. Do you think that there's a chance that things will be derailed because, you know, you've got another election in 5 years' time, 4 or 5 years, and another one after? Is it disrupted at a point that, you know, it's going to be very difficult to get meaningful change through? Or do you think that it can happen within a parliament, or you can build enough consensus around the parties that it can continue without too much disruption after a change of government?
I think there's a lot. I have quite a significant interest in politics, and I did it at A-level as well. So I'll probably have a lot to say about this and the benefits and drawbacks of particular systems and how you achieve change within those systems, etc. But I won't bore listeners with that. I think the fundamental issue with any kind of representative is that they are beholden to the people, as they rightfully should be in a democratic system. But the way particularly our politics has gone, sorry, I'm in danger of doing the thing that I said I wasn't going to
do. That's fine.
But just very briefly, in danger of, yeah, boring listeners. I think with the recent changes that we've had in terms of how politics operates, the type of individuals that get into politics, the expectations around politics and political positions, I think we are in a position where politicians are much more fearful of engaging with issues because of the impact it will have on their electability. Now, personally, I don't think separation should be one of those issues. Me personally, I don't think it's that controversial. I think it's a clear issue. I think it has clear outcomes, and I think it has clear solutions. I think because the issue of domestic violence is so forefronted within our separating processes, sadly, I think that adds a layer of complication, which makes people shy away from the issue and makes it quite complicated. And I think you do have the fundamental limitations of terms, for example. So yes, even politicians now, and I know this because I was on a team assisting with the last election for a party, but you know, as soon as they're elected, they essentially transition to five-year mode, that they're waiting, you know, they're thinking about the next one already. So you will have a situation where parliaments are thinking about not only their electability, but how they fiscally manage a situation. And with an issue like this, it carries a big bill. So you're thinking to yourself, do I want to, as a Labour government, for example, foot a huge bill that I might see the benefits of in this parliament? And if I don't, it might be that the next government takes credit for my achievements, you know, all these kind of considerations.
Right, yeah.
So with all of that in mind, I think the most important thing is to hit the ground running. So we are trying desperately at the moment to get up and running as soon as possible so that we can start engaging with the conversations with this Labour government whilst they still have 4 years and 9 months left, unless an early election is called, which I think is highly doubtful.
Yeah.
We are in a positive position, I think, because of the strength of feeling towards the previous government. I would anticipate potentially that unless this government does something cataclysmically wrong, that we could hope to potentially see two back-to-back terms, which is maybe what we're working with in terms of a timescale. But I think generally the only way to counter that is to just press the urgency of the issue, the scale of the issue, as quickly as possible and try and get as much done within a term as possible. And the good news is that there are quite a few MPs who are interested in the issue, which is great. Quite a lot of new Labour MPs that are interested in the issue. However, the biggest barrier to an APPG, and again, this is a boring side note, but the biggest barrier to an APPG is finding a chair. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of new MPs who aren't ready to be chairs. So it's just about finding a chair, because we've actually got probably a full APPG in terms of support. It's just finding a chair. So we will get there. And when we do, we will be trying to lobby as quickly and as hard as possible for some of these really tangible, clear changes that we see as necessary.
That's good. I don't find it boring, actually, to hear about that. It's because I think hopefully the listeners as well will be really interested in how these mechanisms work within government and across parties. And so the you know, if there's delay in finding a chair, and it's interesting to know that, because I don't know that. Maybe.
And of course, listeners, if you want to, please write to your MP and talk about your strength of feeling on this issue, and mention that you believe that the APPG on separation is necessary as soon as possible. Would they consider speaking about, you know, getting that up and running? You know, that's the power that listeners can have, because that's what it takes. I mean, the point I would add on to that is that there are different structures within Parliament that achieve these different goals. So an APPG is not a select committee, which is what people might find more familiar with, because select committees operate differently and they are much more influential in terms of actually making recommendations to the government. That's not to say APPGs aren't useful, but they are much more kind of informal bodies. They still need MP support and a chair and a vice chair and all this kind of thing. And what they act is kind of data gathering groups. They bring people together, they get information that they can then pass to special advisors that hopefully find its way to ministers. So they it's not as if I'm saying, yeah, we get the APPG up and running, we have a direct line into government, but they are a very important part of the process.
Yeah.
Because what they can do is they can hone in on a much more specific issue, because, for example, committees, they're much broader. You know, you have the selective, you know, they have the Home Office Committee or whatever, or the Select Affairs Committee, which deal with much broader issues. These can go down onto a minute level. So there's APPG for suicide and loneliness and all of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what it does is it allows for that dedicated information gathering that you can then pass on. So yeah, that's one of the ways that, that listeners can help is they can write their MP and say, have you heard of the APPG for separation? Would you consider supporting it? Can you support this issue more broadly, you know, et cetera? Because it all helps in promoting the general awareness of the issue within the body. So, yeah, that's what we're working on at the moment is the APPG.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I think people often wonder what can they do. Would you be able to send me the links on the APPG name or a website if there's one or something, and I can put it in the show notes for listeners?
For sure. Yeah, I'll send you a little summary afterwards and who they can contact.
Great, that's fantastic. Okay, well, thanks very much for talking with me today. We'll begin to wrap up. Would you be able to tell listeners where they can find out more about your work and your books as well? Could you tell us a bit about those as well and where we can find out about them?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is drbenhine.co.uk, all one word. And on there is links to kind of everything that I do. So there's a list of my kind of academic publications. There's links to my books, which I'll talk about in a second. There's also links to my expert witness work as well, if there is individuals that require help with cases, usually alienation cases. And there's also a link to my TED talk, which I did earlier this year, which is all about my experiences of the court system as a child and what I think we need to do better. And that's on YouTube as well. You can just search my name and then TEDx. I've written one book so far, which is about parental alienation specifically, which is a very well-reviewed contemporary guide to the issue. So if anyone is experiencing that within their relationship or wants to know more about that, then that's available on Amazon. Again, you just type in my name and parental alienation, it'll come up. Okay. And I also have a book coming out in December, which is about issues affecting men and boys, which has a chapter on family breakdown in it, where I make clear that it's not an issue that only affects fathers, but that fathers do have uniquely gendered experiences of breakdown, and that draws on my work that I did a few years ago now called the Lost Dads Project, which looks at men's experiences of breakdown from start to finish. So that's where they can go, and I'm on LinkedIn and I'm on X and all these places, so they can read more about me, and my contact details are there as well. So if anybody has any follow-up questions or issues or things they want to talk about, experiences they want to share, anything like that, then my DMs are open, as the kids say, to get in contact.
Yeah. Okay. That's brilliant. Thanks very much. I watched that YouTube, the TED talk myself today, actually. I didn't know about that. That's brilliant. Thanks very much. And I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. Thanks very much again. I've learned so much. I hope the listeners have. And it's really interesting to hear about your research and also the workings of the APPG and also the experiences of places like Finland and just all of the stuff you talked about is a lot of it I didn't know. So I really appreciate you taking the time to.
It was a great conversation. More than happy to come on. I just remembered the other book I would recommend is not my own. It's a recent book that came out this year by Emma Johnson, and it's called The 50-50 Solution, The Surprisingly Simple Choice That Makes Mums, Dads and Kids Happier and Healthier After a Divorce. It's an excellent book that really kind of sets out in a way that I wish I had written, actually, the benefits and the reasons why all of us should be pulling towards a 50-50 arrangement unless there is reason not to do so. So I would recommend that to listeners as well. That's available on Amazon and it's quite cheap. It's only £11 at the moment. So that's a really good read as well.
Great. Okay. And are your books available in audio form as well?
They're not actually. I haven't, because the Parental Alienation book is self-published. That's something that I'm thinking about doing potentially next year, because I know that I've had a few inquiries actually, especially around accessibility and that kind of thing. It maybe watch this space, but at the moment it is available as a paperback, hardback or ebook on
Great.
Amazon.
Okay. Maybe I'm lazy. I tend to
No, I'm the same. I mainly listen to books rather than read them. But it's something I just need to have the time basically just to sit down and record it.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thanks again for talking with us today, Ben. And it's been fantastic discussion, and best wishes, and please keep us informed. I'll share any Twitter links you want me to in future to help spread information about your work, and maybe we can do another episode in the future as well to get an update.
Yeah, absolutely. Just keep in touch, and we'll go from there.
Great. Many thanks, then, Ben. Take care.
Thanks very much. Cheers. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.